the final movement of Beethoven's String Quintet in C major. It was performed there by members of the Nash Ensemble. Do join me again tomorrow when I'll be jumping forward another 3 years or so in Beethoven's life to 1804, when Beethoven was working on his Sonata No. 23, known as the Appassionata.
And that'll be from 6:30 tomorrow evening. Composer of the Week is presented by Donald MacLeod. This is BBC Radio 3. It's time now to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. Waiting for us there is Tom Service.
Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom. Now, we've reached numbers 8 and 7 in that order in Daniel Barenboim's cycle of Beethoven's 9 symphonies with his West Eastern Divan Orchestra. And in between them, before the interval, we're going to hear another piece by French composer Pierre Boulez, his ethereal Anthème 2 for solo violin and live electronics. Now, this particular combination of Beethoven and Boulez is something that Daniel Barenboim has thought long and hard about, as he told me earlier today.
Anthem 2 after the 8th symphony is very good between the 8th and the 7th, because if you think about it, the 8th and the 7th, neither of them has a real slow movement. Therefore, you don't get in this program the tonal aspect of legato playing, which is so typical Beethoven. But the 7th and 8th symphonies are very kind of physical, energetic symphonies, and Anthem 2 has such a wonderfully developed sound world.
Daniel Barenboim. And so we're going to hear the 8th symphony, so often the Cinderella of the cycle. Just because it's shorter doesn't mean it's any less significant. The first movement is a bracing allegro. The second movement is probably the strangest single movement in Beethoven's entire symphonic canon. Then comes a third movement that's really a parody of a menuet, and then a finale, one of the weirdest and bravest movements that that Ludwig van Beethoven ever wrote. So here comes Daniel Barenboim to conduct his West Eastern Divan Orchestra in this performance of Beethoven's Symphony No. 8 in F major. Beethoven's 8th Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall. Daniel Barenboim conducted his West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Barenboim accepts his applause from another sellout Royal Albert Hall for this Beethoven series. You know, that piece is sometimes patronised a bit, I think, as if it was about just musical humour of some kind. But if it is funny, it's telling jokes, really the most existential, profound kind of jokes about what music really is. That final movement, there's some great stuff from David Cairns in tonight's programme note, which you can read at bbc.co.uk/proms, where he says the derisiveness of those braying woodwind thirds just before the end, the manically insistent final chords, like a parody of the Fifth Symphony. The Fifth Symphony, of course, that we heard last night. You don't know when that symphony's going to end. It seems to end about three times. As Daniel Barenboim, now in the strings of his West Eastern Divan Orchestra, brings the woodwind and brass sections to the feet, and now the strings too. Daniel Barenboim is telling me today that each of Beethoven's symphonies is a new template, a template for a different kind of symphony. And that's true above all of the Eighth Symphony. A symphony without a slow movement, that weird allegretto that came second, which ends seemingly too soon. Inspired possibly, actually probably not, but it could have been by a warped metronome. Well, Beethoven's Seventh Symphony coming up after the interval, but now another piece by French composer Pierre Boulez. Michael Barenboim, Daniel's son and leader of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra for every Beethoven prom, apart from this one, plays En Thème Deux for solo violin and live electronics. Now, this is a piece of real expressive intimacy, of meditation, even devotion. I asked Michael Barenboim what it felt like to be playing En Thème Deux in the gigantic maw of the Royal Albert Hall.
I've never played it in a place that's so big, but I think that it's acoustically, it's actually perfect. What you're supposed to hear when you hear En Thème Deux is that some things are far away and some things are close, and you, at some point you don't know what is being played live and what is electronic. And in this hall, of course, this is amplified to 6,000 people, where you really get this feeling even stronger. So I think it's great.
But you sense something special happening in the connection between Beethoven and Boulez as you're playing.
Yes, that's that, I mean, there's what makes them similar is also a sense that they both were an achievement of something and the beginning of something new at the same time. So Beethoven basically closed the classical period and started a new way of composing, which is best exemplified in the first movement of the Fifth. And with Boulez also, to have closure on a period that ended with the end of the Second World War and to start a completely new way of writing music that was in that period, and then to reinvent himself with pieces like Répond and even at the end pieces like this, using electronic things like this. Those are similarities that are worth noting.
Watching the rehearsals, this has often been like watching a family, a musical family get together, led by Daniel Barenboim, your father. I mean, that's particularly true, of course, for you. I mean, what's the experience of leading this orchestra like for you musically and personally?
For me personally, I basically grew up with this orchestra. The first time I came, I was 14, and now I'm 26. The way we approach music, all of this is part of the way I grew up. But in general, when we rehearse or play a concert, and I'm leading the orchestra, I don't see my father in front of me. I see the conductor that has to say or do something. You forget that it's a family thing, which it isn't.
Michael Barenboim. Well, as so often with Pierre Boulez, the piece that we're about to hear, En Thème Deux, is an expanded version of another Boulez piece, perhaps not surprisingly, called En Thème Un, composed for solo violin. The title is another Boulezian hybrid of the words anthem and themes, and this is a piece of almost continual melody. Yes, the melodies are ornamented by trills and given a sumptuous halo of electronic sound, but there are themes that you can hear returning throughout the piece and its seven sections, or six sections rather. Now, each part is a different station of the music structure, and Michael Barenboim will make his way along a semicircle of six music stands that I can see at the front of the Royal Albert Hall stage throughout the 25 minutes of En Thème Deux. And you'll be able to hear distinctly how each of the sections starts with some ethereal and gliding harmonics. And you'll also hear that there's a contrast in the music between faster kinds of material, which uses the whole arsenal of violin techniques, harmonics, pizzicatos, hitting the instrument with all parts of the bow. And then there are slower lyrical lines as well. You know, really to enjoy En Thème, all you need to do is open your ears to this heightened, surreal sound world and imagine yourself floating in another realm of sound, of feeling. That's something that's been happening throughout the Boulez performances of this Beethoven cycle here at the Royal Albert Hall that Daniel Barenboim's been leading with the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. It's fascinating to hear what Michael Barenboim is saying about that comparison between Beethoven and Boulez, that they both bring to fruition a period of music history, Beethoven's case, the classical period, and a kind of modernist way of thinking about music for Pierre Boulez, and then take it somewhere else. Now, the fascinating thing for Pierre Boulez is to think that a piece like this, the piece we're about to hear, En Thème Deux, really represents the height of Pierre Boulez's style, where his music was always going. Here he comes on stage now, Michael Barenboim, to play Pierre Boulez's En Thème Deux for solo violin and live electronics. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Barenboim is the soloist in that first Proms performance of Pierre Boulez's On Thème Deux. Magical sense of how the acoustic sounds, the live sounds that Michael Barenboim was making were mixing and being changed and filtered with the live electronics, which were being mixed in the Royal Albert Hall by Gilbert Nuno and Jeremy Enhol from IRCAM, the Institute for Research into Computer and Acoustic Music that Pierre Boulez set up in the mid-1970s. En Thème Deux, one of its more recent products, that piece was written in 1997. It relates, though, fascinatingly to much earlier music. In choosing this title, Boulez says, I was influenced by a childhood memory of the psalms that were sung during Holy Week, the lamentations of the prophet Jeremiah, and by their clear strophic structure, verse, strophe. That's what we heard in the seven sections of En Thème Deux. Michael Barenboim coming on stage again here at the Royal Albert Hall to accept this huge applause. At the very end of the piece, the hall was plunged into darkness very briefly before that final little chirrup from Michael Barenboim's violin that ended the piece, enhancing the sense, I felt, of the reflective, meditative quality of that music. Well, I don't know about you, I'm feeling just a little inspired about feeling after hearing En Thème Deux. I can almost feel the words of a poem forming. Funny I should say that, though, because if you can too, then you should know that this year Ian McMillan will be hosting a Proms poetry competition for adults and for children. All you have to do is write a poem inspired by Boulez, Beethoven, or indeed any piece of music from this year's Proms season. There are categories for both children and adults, and the winners will have their poems performed at a Proms Plus event and then broadcast on BBC Radio 3. You'll also be invited to come to a BBC Proms concert, as if that wasn't enough, at the Royal Albert Hall, of course. Now, all the details, including terms and conditions, are online. Just type BBC Proms Poetry into your search engine or click through from the Radio 3 homepage. The deadline, though, is Friday, 10th of August. So time now to put pen to paper. And why not write about En Thème Deux by Pierre Boulez? Well, interval time now in tonight's prom. And so it's time to join Ed Sturton and his guests for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, which was recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello. The West Eastern Divan Orchestra, which is performing tonight's prom, was inspired by the belief that art can influence politics. Daniel Barenboim and the late Edward Said founded it to encourage dialogue in the Middle East. In this conversation this evening, we're going to flip that proposition around, really. We're asking how politics can influence art, specifically how the political developments we've come to know as the Arab Spring are influencing writing. And we're joined by the novelist and commentator Adaf Swaif and by Carl Sharrow, an architect based here in London who also writes and blogs on the Middle East. And I think, Carl, you've got family in Syria, which must be a very tense thing at the moment.
Absolutely, yes. But my background as well is Lebanese and Iraqi, so
you get that. You cover plenty of bases.
All very peaceful countries.
Yeah. Indeed, yes. Well, Adaf Swaif, the last time we met was actually in Cairo when you very kindly gave an interview for a Radio 4 series that I was doing at the time. And I remember you telling me that the revolution in Egypt had really changed everything. And I think it's also changed your writing a bit, hasn't it? I mean, you used to be, still are, very well known as a novelist, but you are now a regular political commentator.
The biggest change for me in this last 18 months has been that I now write a column in Arabic. I could translate into Arabic and I could edit, but I couldn't start from scratch and produce a piece of writing in Arabic, and I have done that. And it's now a year and 2 months that I have produced a weekly column for Shuru', so that's been a big change.
And you've also written a book of the revolution, as it were, called Cairo, My City, Our Revolution, which you have with you. and you're going to read to us a bit from that.
Sure.
In
the novel I was working on before the revolution happened, there's a scene that was written in August 2007. Mada is talking to Asya about the museum. This is the Egyptian museum in Tahrir, the pharaonic museum. You know, says Mada, it's unbelievable. It's as if the city doesn't even belong to us. A soldier stopped me from walking near the museum in Tahrir the other day, in the center of Cairo. He said, it's forbidden to walk here. I couldn't believe it. How do you mean forbidden? It's forbidden. I pointed at a whole load of people walking into the museum. He said, "They're foreigners." "Are you serious? What if I want to go to the museum?" He said, "Why should you go to the museum?" I said, "Haven't you noticed it's called the Egyptian Museum? And haven't you noticed this square is called Liberation Square? Do you know who it was liberated from? It was liberated from the foreigners, for us, the Egyptian people." "And what did he say?" asks Asya. "He said, 'You'll have to speak to the officer.'" A great cry goes up from the square. "Irhal, irhal, leave." Everybody's looking in the same direction. From the sixth floor balcony of an Art Deco building, a long banner unfurls, falling gracefully down the front. We read, "Leave, we want to breathe." Holding it from the balcony is a young woman with streaming, curly hair. She's jumping up and down and holding up her hand in a victory salute. The crowd salute back. Irhal, irhal.
And that chant, in fact, has become a song. It was Rami Essam, a young student who became the troubadour of the revolution. I suppose I don't know if that's the right expression. But obviously there has been a great boost to protest music of that kind.
Every kind of protest. I mean, Rami is a case in point. He plays the guitar and he is a student and he used to just sing among friends. And then, you know, everybody was bringing whatever they could. So, you know, people were bringing their guitars or their drums or, you know, biscuits or whatever. You brought what you had. And he brought his guitar and started singing in the square, and just people were singing after him, and it hit a nerve. Rami was the second of February, after the Battle of the Camel, when we kind of regained possession of the Midan, we realized that basically we were being attacked in the square by the thug militias of Mubarak, not by regular forces. And the army, which was supposed to be protecting everybody, was standing by doing nothing, presumably being neutral because everybody's Egyptian, the thugs and the revolutionaries. And then on the 3rd of February, we realized that people were being taken into the Egyptian Museum by the army and beaten up. And we kind of couldn't believe it, and we went, and anyway, it was a whole story. But the next day, Rami Azam came out of there. He vanished that night. We didn't know where he was. We suspected he was inside. And he came out the following day, and he was the first actual proof we had, because his back was crisscrossed with welts and cigarette burns. And he came out, and with a bare back in February, he sang in the Midan. And that was the first kind of like turning against the military.
Carl Scherer, I promised I hadn't forgotten you, and I haven't. You have chosen to focus on a slightly different form of expression, the blog. Why? Why is that the medium of the Arab Spring for you?
I think one very distinctive thing about the Arab uprisings, let's call them, I prefer that to the term, the Arab Spring, is they weren't theorized. There wasn't a political theory ahead of this revolution that explained what they were about. They were almost an explosion of a moment of pure, spontaneous, popular anger. And in the aftermath, we have this sort of fumbling. It's almost like a fumbling, an attempt to make sense of what happened. And I think that's very interesting that it happened in this online medium, where spontaneously all these people that probably never wrote anything before, we're trying to grapple with this new reality, understand what it's about. But it was also a personal thing. So you have these gems, you come across these gems, and I focused on two pieces from Syria over here, I think because that's the grayest area in all of the Arab uprising. But as well, it's the most promising. There's these decades of repression, and there's a moment of hope, and there's all these young people pushing and exploring. And in that process of exploring, trying to find meaning, I think there are beautiful pieces of work that are coming out. Perhaps it's not literature in the conventional sense, But it reveals a lot about the state of mind and the aspirations of the people at the moment.
I think we'd better hear your first gem.
Yeah, I need a bit of introduction. So that's one of my favorite Syrian bloggers. She writes under a pseudonym. It's Amal Hanano, and it's made up. Amal is hope in Arabic, and Hanano is the surname of one of the leaders of the fight for independence against the French. So her identity is, in fact, a symbol for the Syrian struggle. And she's writing, it's a recent piece, it's entitled 1 Year of Hope. And she starts by a quote from Tale of Two Cities, the Charles Dickens novel. You know, it was the best of times, it was worst of time. It was a year of losses and a year of gains. I began by observing the revolution from the inside, but I didn't start living it until many months later, while on the outside. I went from speaking of the dead I watched on YouTube to speaking to the dead before they died. I entered the month of February still intact and emerged with my own emotional revolutionary wounds. What we had gained the month before by breaking the walls of fear, we lost as we watched Homs being destroyed, shell by shell. After the fateful February of 2012, neither the revolution nor the regime was winning or losing. It had become a battle of survival, and everyone wondered, will we survive or not? And we knit together Syria's bloody destiny, every murder intertwined with injustice, every revenge a setback, every chant a victory. Our revolution began in a moment of indignity and humiliation too great to bear, like Dickens' French peasant child crushed under the wheels of nobility. But it also revealed what we had concealed as a people for decades. Our ultimate fear was not the fear of the unknown, or even the fear of tyranny. It was the fear of exposing what we had tried to hide, the universal truth that everyone tries to hide. But this time in history, it was Syria's lot to rip itself apart and have its secrets revealed to a silently observing, judgmental world, that the best and the worst, wisdom and foolishness, belief and incredulity, light and darkness, the spring of hope and the winter of despair exist together within us all.
It's very, very powerful stuff. And I suppose one of the things that's interesting about it is it is trying to make sense of something before the outcome is known, in a way, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's that kind of struggle for meaning and the struggle for certainty that was completely lost, in a way. And it's through this process that's by no means clear. And people, you know, they're trying to arrive both at a kind of collective sense of understanding, but as well as an individual sense of meaning, an individual sense of kind of achievement and relationship to the world. And I think that's why it's very kind of touching and informative in a way.
And I don't know, this is an appropriate question when the revolution is still unfolding, but do you think that that sort of writing will survive? I mean, do blogs of that kind have the permanence, if you like, of the sort of thing that Adaf writes?
It's a bit of an unfair question, but I think, in a way, their temporality is probably part of their resonance. Because, in a way, if we all forget about all these texts in a couple of years from now, it means they serve their purpose.
Let's hear your second gem.
A bit more lighthearted. And this is from another anonymous Syrian blogger as well. His name is Maysaloun. And it begins by what I think is a very common sort of conversation we regularly, Arabs who are in the West, have with our relatives back home. Can you get me and my family a visa? That was what a cousin of mine asked me today, and I didn't have the heart to tell him that there was nothing I could do. I told him, I promised that I'd do everything I could. I told myself that it wasn't really a lie, because it was the truth. then it skips. I'm going to skip forward. And he starts sort of reconstructing this relationship in the cousin and remembers when he went to his wedding in Damascus. It was strange that also in the street behind us, a family were holding a wake for somebody who just died. That was the cheerful part of it. This was Damascus, a wedding in one street and a funeral in another. For some reason, we always see the two together. The music and car horns were silent as we drove somberly past them, and the family standing at the door to greet people who were paying their respects smiled at us. Then we all drove the happy couple down the highway that night, horns blazing, cars festooned with flowers and ribbons, and his friends and I racing around acting like complete imbeciles as we zipped between the microbuses and the cheap Suzukis with families in the back waving at us as we drove fast. There were over 20 cars in that entourage that night, and it was glorious. We might as well have been a presidential motorcade. Then fast forward towards the end. Today, my cousin seemed desperate and miserable, and his wonderful little world and everything he knew was collapsing around him. And I'm watching from far away, and there isn't a goddamn thing I can do about it. It is like we have lost all our innocence since then. Now that lovely night seems a lifetime ago, and those happy times already look like old photos in a tattered album.
And it's not head-on about the revolution, but the poignancy comes from the fact, presumably, that implicit in the hope of the revolution is that one day people won't say, can you get me a visa? I mean, that great question won't be asked.
Yeah, exactly. I think I purposefully... he writes this astoundingly beautiful analytical pieces from a political point of view, but I had to go through it extensively to find a piece that wasn't directly about politics, because I wanted to kind of capture this moment of uncertainty. You know, in the beginning of revolutions, there's this sort of sense of black and white, we're going to prevail, this is what's it about. But then when it goes on and becomes a protracted process, there are all these questions, there are all these uncertainties, and you see people trying to deal with that and respond to that. And also what I liked about it is it brings in this weight of history in places like Damascus, when you're living in a place that's been inhabited continuously for 7,000 years. It's sort of, there's always that pressure and weight of history that determines your future. So there's a glimpse here, there's a moment of hope, but there's all this baggage behind, and this is what I like, that combination between the two.
Well, what about the climate in which you're all working now? I mean, Egypt is in such a sort of delicate, pivotal, poised position, one feels at the moment. Nobody's quite sure which way things are going to go. Do you feel that the freedom of expression that you've enjoyed for the past few months is there for good?
This is a really big question, because, I feel like questioning every assumption behind it.
Well, do go ahead. You're allowed to be rude to the moderators.
No, not at all. People have been writing against the regime for a long time. And basically, the regime discovered that it could just let them do what they wanted. You know, fine, you write. See what that's going to change. So that has not really been an issue.
Right.
And in fact, people are now known by, like, who did it before and who just joined in after. So that's, absolutely. So we've all been out there and sort of, writing and marching and doing all that. Freedom of expression, I think we're all writing what we want to write, and I think that the internet and the blogs and the tweets and so on have really pushed the boundaries a lot, even for print, because when you've got people saying what they say, out in cyberspace, then that pushes the boundaries for everybody, and so that's great. They do send you messages, obviously. A story, a personal story, is, and that's how you know where the red lines are. So I've been writing this column that I've been going on about, and once I wrote, I think it was in May, my column was about a protest that we had outside the Ministry of Defense, and how, as we were all leaving, a lot of young people were still there chanting. And it was the end of the weekend, so as we were heading to the tube, we saw the young cadets coming back from the weekend. And so there were these, you know, young Egyptians, the cadets, who were about to go past the protesting young Egyptians into their college. And there they were going to be told again what criminals and traitors and agents their, you know, compatriots outside were, and so on. So I wrote that. And sort of, you know, I thought it was pretty anodyne how I kind of brought all the young people together and hoped that Egypt would, like, be good to all of them, and so on. And I actually got a phone call from General Rouhani, one of the members of the Supreme Council, a powerful member of the Supreme Military Council, and the military governor of Cairo. And he was on the phone for an hour because of that column. And this was entirely weird, I thought. But clearly what had happened there was the line that had been crossed was that you were turning the army against, you know, you were sort of basically trying to turn the cadets against their institution and their commanding officer. And that was a line that, you know, you should, and one didn't know that.
I'd say it's not unknown for politicians in this country to rear us up. But Carl, a very different picture in Syria. I mean, and the bloggers that you read out, they are finding a voice that people in Syria just didn't have in the old days.
Absolutely. This is the kind of the point I wanted to highlight about the difference between Egypt and Syria. It was radically different because sort of the regime in Syria didn't even give that luxury of go and write. So that's why there's this moment of excitement and buzz, you know. It's opened up all these new avenues. I mean, even in some forms, there's no way you can classify them in any conventional sense, but there's this one particular village that's now become very skilled in writing these very comic signs in English called Kfar Nabal, this village. So everybody waits for their demonstrations on a Friday. It's almost like a genre that what is the next joke is coming out of Kfar Nabal. And there's no way you can classify that kind of thing. But there's certainly all this creativity being put into kind of expressing their situation. And I think the vlogs as well, they were this opportunity for this freedom that wasn't there before.
Can you give us an example of the sort of jokes they make?
Well, the only one that I can remember recently is pretty crass.
Oh, okay. I mean, not repeatable.
I'll just say, if you search for Kfar Nabal in Google and look for the date of last Friday,
they'll find it. Okay, we'll leave it at that. I'm sure we could go on for a long time, but very sadly, we have run out of time. Adolf Swaif and Carl Sharrow, thank you both very much indeed.
Ed Sturton presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Zahid Warley. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's Prom. Daniel Barenboim conducts the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, who are being applauded richly again by the Royal Albert Hall audience in Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. That study in rhythmic obsession and churning harmonic experimentation that had one commentator saying that Beethoven was ripe for the madhouse. I know what he meant, too. Because just like the Eighth, but in a completely different way, the Seventh is a symphony of extremes that's still unique in music history. Before then, we're going to hear more from Daniel Barenboim. After rehearsal this morning, I asked him how he was feeling this far into his Beethoven cycle and why it was so special for him to play it here at the Proms with this orchestra, which he founded with Edward Said, the philosopher and writer, in 1999.
I'm having a lot of fun, and I'm very grateful, really, that I had the possibility in my life to be able to have founded an orchestra like this, trained it, and to arrive at a point where the whole orchestra basically thinks the same thing musically. That's really what it is about. You know, when people talk about music, I think they talk about all sorts of things which are very important, articulation, style, etc., etc. But the actual important subject is how to think in and with music. You have to think before you play. You cannot just play the first note without any proper. You have to think, what do I want to hear?
Do you learn from them too?
I learn, I can tell you exactly. When you have been active in music as long as I have, next month, 62 years on the stage, obviously there are a lot of things which are self-understood. As natural as when you start walking, you start walking. But when suddenly somebody asks you, when you walk, do you walk first with the right or with the left foot? You have to stop and think. That's what they have done to me.
Daniel Barenboim. So we're going to hear Daniel Barenboim conduct Beethoven's Seventh Symphony now. Written in 1811 and 1812, just before the Eighth, the symphony is another piece, as Barenboim has said at the start of tonight's prom, that doesn't really have a slow movement. Instead, there's the famous Allegretto that comes second, whose relentless A minor tread is as much a study in rhythm as the first movement's nearly ceaseless repetitions of a single dotted rhythm. More of that for about 12 minutes in the Allegro of the first movement. The scherzo is another innovation with its repetitions and more repetitions of both the scherzo music and the slightly slower trio, but it's in the finale, the last movement, where Beethoven really loses it. I think this music really is a kind of madness. It ought to sound on a precipice of musical excitement and possibility. And above all, there's one place where you'll hear, it's really an almost unbelievable passage near the end, where there's a churning dissonance in the cellos and double basses, which they hang on to, this huge dissonance, even after the rest of the orchestra have resolved onto another chord. A moment of elemental energy in a whole movement that's just about the most relentless that Beethoven ever composed. A musical thrill ride we're in for now here at the Royal Albert Hall. Daniel Barenboim comes on stage to conduct Beethoven's Seventh Symphony in A major with the West Eastern Divan Orchestra.
Thank you.
Beethoven's Seventh Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall. Daniel Barenboim conducted, inspired, cajoled, catalyzed the West Eastern Divan Orchestra in that performance. He turns to face the audience and take this huge applause. It's something he hasn't done for the whole series so far. As soon as that performance finished, he was tapping on, applauding the desks of his front desk of the first violins and second violins, tapping their music stands as if to celebrate with them, or at least to give him some relief after that absolutely monumentally thrilling performance here. Barenboim really emphasised the relentless rhythmic obsession of that piece by playing all four movements as if it was one connected suite. There was no gap or as little gap as possible between each of the movements, giving his players hardly chance to draw breath between the first movement and the slow movement, and the audience just time to deal with what had just happened before the next movement crashed in, especially in the finale there. Daniel Barenboim comes on stage here again. Well, that's kind of what I thought and what this audience here at the Royal Albert Hall thought. Join the conversation on Twitter at BBC Proms to share your thoughts about that performance of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Daniel Barenboim stands there behind the second violins, the violas, to let the orchestra take the applause here. There is, of course, more to Beethoven's music than his symphonies. Donald MacLeod is exploring Beethoven's music throughout this week, as Beethoven is the composer of the week. And there's still one installment left in this complete Beethoven cycle of all nine symphonies, the Ninth Symphony coming up on Friday. But now, though, with this applause getting close to the rhythmic energy of what we've just experienced in that performance of the Seventh Symphony, time to hand you on to Broadcasting House and Jonathan Swain. Jonathan.
Tom, thank you very much. Tom Service there at a fairly possessed Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, you can listen to that prom again anytime you like for the next 7 days via the Radio 3 website. We'll also be broadcasting it again here on the good old wireless next Monday afternoon here on Radio 3 at 2 o'clock. Well, that's the first of two proms tonight. As for tonight's second prom, it's with the Kronos Quartet, and expect the unexpected. For almost 40 years now, the Kronos Quartet has been reinventing the string quartet, regularly turning it into a multimedia experience. It's the group's first ever proms appearance tonight, and it begins with high-octane Syrian folk pop and ends with a Kronos commission, blending classical strings with ethnic Balkan instruments, shouts, foot stomping, bells and electronic overdubs. Along the way, they'll be playing Sofia Gubaidulina's fourth string quartet and another quartet based on Amazing Grace. Back to the Royal Albert Hall live for that here on BBC Radio 3 at 10 o'clock. Before then, we've the first of a series of four features this week on the American Civil War. That's in just over 10, I should say 11 minutes' time at 9:15. For the moment, Gypsy Songs by Dvorak. You can hear Dvorak's Seventh Symphony in tomorrow night's prom. The singer is Gabriela Benochkova and the pianist is Rudolf Firkuzny.
Ich bin's mit dir, Kloni, der Röcher, wo wir's rein, wo wir's rein.
four of the Gypsy Songs, Opus 55 by Dvorak. The singer was Gabriela Benachkova and the pianist Rudolf Fierkuschny. And as I say, you can hear Dvorak's Seventh Symphony, Jerzy Bielochlawek conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra in tomorrow night's Prom, along with George Sell's orchestration of Smetana's autobiographical first string quartet. That's live here on BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms, starting at 7:30 tomorrow night. Well, back to this evening. It's just gone 9:15, and over the course of four evenings this week, we're broadcasting again a documentary series on the American Civil War, first heard in April last year. 150 years ago, the American Civil War tested and tempered a nation that saw itself as a unique experiment in democracy. In the first part of the series this evening, historian Adam Smith explores the contradictions and crises that drove the War of the South.
As we entered into Iraq, and I noticed how quickly people could claim to hate people they didn't even know, almost overnight, I was struck by the puzzle of how did white Americans with the same religion, same ethnicity, same soil, same climate, generate enough hatred in a matter of weeks to go to war, to kill each other, to lose 620,000 people in a war that would be sustained for 4 years.
In the middle of the 19th century, the American Union was booming and on the move, expanding ever westwards, the great democratic experiment. Politicians spoke of their nation's manifest destiny to impose their will on a vast continent. Yet there was a fatal line of division at the heart of this restless nation. It was half slave and half free. Should Americans be allowed to take their slaves, their human property, with them as they moved west? And was the institution of slavery itself safe in the hands of a dynamic, expanding, free white North? Between December 1860 and April 1861, 11 slave states announced that they were leaving the Union. They seceded. Secession was the greatest challenge the American Republic has ever faced. In this series, I'll be exploring how and why the Union survived and how the Civil War continues to echo today. But I'll begin by going south.
The South, by the 1850s, saw itself through its leadership as a slave society.
David Blight, Yale University.
Now, they didn't call themselves that in every sense, but they were a burgeoning, growing, wealthy kingdom of cotton, a growing slave money crop empire.
We've forgotten this was the largest and most powerful system of slavery in the modern world.
Ed Ayres, president of the University of Richmond.
It covered an area the size of continental Europe, worth more than all the factories and banks and railroads of the North combined. It drove the production of the single largest commodity in the entire world. And so the idea that that could be destroyed did not seem possible.
Leadership of the American South by the 1850s were almost entirely planters, slaveholders, large landowners, and they were, as a defined class, the wealthiest group of Americans by far. There were more millionaires, for example, in the broader Mississippi Valley than anywhere else in the United States. Their dilemma, of course, is that they are becoming, in their view, surrounded not only by this even larger, growing northern free labor society, which wants to expand west just as much as they do, they're also surrounded to a degree ideologically. They're now living in a world as this largest of all slave societies.
Slavery and Republican freedom are sometimes seen as natural antagonists, yet in America, they'd grown up together. When at the time of the Revolution, Dr. Johnson sardonically asked why it was that we hear the loudest yelps for freedom from the drivers of slaves, the answer was not necessarily, as he assumed, that they were mere hypocrites, but but that bondage for black people heightened white men's sense of the importance of their own freedom. Slavery was bound into the sinews of the American Republic, protected by its Constitution, sanctioned by its founding fathers. To the South, it was Northerners who had diverged from the American tradition. Southerners saw themselves as the upholders of the spirit of 1776, of a pro-slavery unionism for which their forefathers had fought and died. Gary Gallagher, University of Virginia.
Both sides wanted to be right with the founders, there's no question about that, and they argued that it was, in fact, the northern states that had moved away from the promise of the founding generation. The United States, after all, was a slaveholding nation. The Constitution protected slavery. The Confederate states said that they were the true inheritors of the revolutionary tradition, that it was this looming, powerful, intrusive central government in Washington that departed from the vision of the founding generation. The Constitution alludes to slavery three times without ever using the word slave or the word slavery. There is a compromise in how enslaved people would be counted for representation and taxation, the famous or infamous three-fifths compromise of the Constitution, which said every slave would be counted as three-fifths of a person for purposes of representation and taxation. There was a part of the Constitution that said the transatlantic slave trade could continue for 20 years, that it would be abolished. And there was also a clause in the Constitution that dealt with the return of fugitive slaves that said that the power of the government would be brought to bear to return slaves who had escaped from their owners. So they're not making up the fact that the Constitution protects slave property. It did.
The core problem for slaveholders was that most of their wealth was tied up in property that had legs and voices. Having the courts and ultimately the physical power of the state on your side is crucial if you want a disputable claim to property to be upheld. Consequently, slaveholders made sure that for most of the first 70 years of the existence of the United States, they were the most powerful political force in the nation. Elizabeth Varon, the University of Virginia.
A vanguard of Southerners begins to make the argument, and it's an argument that they press for a long time, at first not with much success, that the existing political system cannot be trusted. An argument that they root in a constitutional theory that the Constitution is a compact or treaty between the states that can be revoked if the states insist, rooted in fear that slaveholders, a minority in their own section, are fast becoming a minority in the Union, that northern and southern cultures are different and antagonistic, but it takes some time to catch on because for much of the antebellum period, the Democratic Party does represent the interests of slaveholders, and it's not until the Democratic Party slips and loses that power that southern slaveholders are able to say the existing system can't be trusted.
The rise of a new, exclusively northern political party was a profoundly disturbing development. The Black Republican Party, as Southerners always called it, with its opposition to the expansion of slavery, represented values Southerners found utterly alien. As European immigrants teamed into the free states of the North, filling the new cities, settling the expanding West, the South seemed doomed to be an ever-decreasing minority. Other slaveholding elites elsewhere in the 19th century world responded to this kind of pressure by playing for time. Here, they fought back. At first within the Union, by trying to admit more slave states and protecting their honor with violence, even on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
One of the things that comes through the pro-slavery writing and fantasizing and polemicizing is the idea that it is possible for the South to build a pro-slavery empire.
Harvard University's Walter Johnson.
A pro-slavery empire that embraces the Caribbean, that controls Nicaragua and the passageway to the Pacific, and in fact joins the Mississippi Valley with the Amazon as a hemispheric slave-holding complex.
Often when we think of Southern slavery, we think of big plantations with Spanish moss dripping from a line of oak trees. And that was indeed the reality for millions of slaves further south. But this place tells a very different story. I'm on the banks of the James River in the remains of what was the Tredegar Ironworks. This place poured out millions of tons of armaments for the Confederate Army during the war. And it was slaves, the slaves who worked here. So this place reminds us that slavery was a highly adaptable institution. Far from being some sort of pre-modern throwback, mid-19th century American slavery was a modern capitalist institution.
I think you have to get to this ideological realm to explain why people are willing to go to war.
Eric Foner, Columbia University.
Economically, there's no reason why capitalism and slavery can coexist. You can make profits off slavery. Many in the North, you know, in New York and other places, were making plenty of money off slavery. The cotton textile mills in New England were using the cotton grown by slaves. But I think the economic growth of capitalism is producing an ideology, which I've called an ideology of free labor, which exalts free labor as superior to slave labor, and exalts northern society as superior to southern society, and that there needed to be a concerted political response to that in a way maybe that hadn't been necessary 20 or 30 years earlier.
In November 1860, the new Republican Party, mobilizing the support of the free states, elected Abraham Lincoln as president. Lincoln wasn't even on the ballot in most of the slave states. For many in the South, this was the pivotal moment that tipped the balance against the Union. A few weeks after the presidential election, the state of South Carolina declared that it had seceded. And by the time Lincoln was actually inaugurated, which was 3 months later in March 1861, six more states had left the Union. Yet some northernmost slave states, including the most venerable of them all, Virginia, hesitated. The first shots of the war were fired against a federal fort, Fort Sumter, in Charleston, South Carolina. And it was in response to that that President Lincoln issued a call to all the states, including the slave states, to contribute troops to put down insurrection. And to many in a state like Virginia, that constituted an unwarranted usurpation of states' rights by the federal government. It was the last straw.
I love it when people tell me, and they often do, that it's really a war about states' rights. And I ask them to please just list the two or three principal states' rights that people were concerned about. And just list the two. What are the two states' rights? There's really only one state right that anybody's worried about, and that is the right, the power of a state to interpose its authority between a central government that is some way menacing slavery and slaveholders who live in that state. That's what states' rights is about.
Secession turned out to be a catastrophic miscalculation. But white Virginians meeting here in the Capitol building in April 1861, brought together to debate the question of whether Virginia should leave the Union, they felt by the 17th of April that they had no choice but to make this fateful gamble. On the one hand, their history burdened them with a loyalty to the old Union. But cold political calculation in the end pushed them the other way. One of the delegates here in the many days of speeches on this question said that nations act on their interests, not on their sentiments. And Virginia's interest was in protecting slavery.
Secessionists really tried to portray themselves as the conservatives, the ones trying to preserve the original legacy. At other times, they suggested that they were really repudiating the mistakes of the past and launching a new experiment, if you will.
This is an extraordinary thing to attempt to do in the middle of the 19th century, to establish a slaveholders' republic.
Right.
And one of the things that strikes me is how overt many Confederate leaders were in their proclamations that that is what the Confederacy was seeking to do.
Some of them really repudiate the idea of a free society and say a slave society is better, more stable, more traditional, less vulnerable. So they seem confident. Now, it's important to note that all along there are Southerners, including white Southern slaveholders, including quite wealthy white Southern slaveholders, who argue the Unionist case, who say, look, we can never win this war. This is madness. The North has more of everything, produces more of everything. And it's folly to imagine that this is a winnable war. But the secessionists argue that they can win, and that argument is based on this peculiar understanding of the legacy of the Revolution, but it's also based on a set of stereotypes about the North and about the North's lack of preparedness, lack of will, lack of martial ardor, lack of manhood. Their main argument was that the South had all the advantages in the coming conflict, that slavery itself was an advantage because it would generate labor power and wealth for the South as it had. Secession said, yeah, we'll win the war and it'll be short, but not so short that you young men won't have a chance to earn considerable glory and to come back wreathed in laurels and to have proven yourselves the equal of the revolutionary forefathers.
They really have taken a revolutionary act and cast their fate in something now called the Confederate States of America. They, in effect, appoint as much as they ever elected Jefferson Davis as president, and they move their capital from Montgomery, Alabama, up to Richmond, Virginia. Now, Jefferson Davis and his cabinet faces this dilemma of how do you now, practically overnight, centralize this conglomeration of states into fighting an all-out war effort? How do you nationalize the economy? How do you develop a centralized transportation system? What do you do about cotton production? How do you keep an active labor force? How do you build iron forgeries where you haven't had any? You know, how do you develop a foreign policy? How do you create a navy? It is truly remarkable that the Confederacy was as successful as it was.
If someone wants to understand the American Civil War, I think the Shenandoah Valley, which is one of the most beautiful places in the United States, here's a place that you can see the entire Civil War in a short geographic compass, because here are people of exactly the same soil, same climate. We think sometimes the Civil War is between the hot Southerners and the frigid Yankees and cotton versus codfish or whatever. There's no of these explanations here. There's just one difference, and it's slavery. That you're fighting not for an economic interest, but for what you see as a new nation that is going to be honestly based on slavery and on white supremacy. Now, that may seem a fine distinction, but without that layer, you don't have patriotism, you don't have the whole rhetoric of fighting for home. If you're just fighting to protect property, you cannot sustain a war for 4 years.
Jonathan Worth, North Carolina. I have been forced by surrounding facts to take sides, or rather front with my section, but I do not have a particle of confidence in the new rulers to whom we submit. I leave the flag of Union and the flag of Washington because I am subjected and forced to submit to my master, democracy, to testing it with more and more intensity as I become better acquainted with its objects. I think the South is committing political suicide, but my lot is cast with the South, and being unable to manage the ship, I intend to face the breakers manfully and go down with my companions.
These identities had to be created. It was not just a descendant of generations-old grudges. Because in the Shenandoah Valley, people had voted to stay in the Union till the very last minute. They pled with their counterparts down in the Tidewater, please don't leave. But when they did, these people in the valley gave themselves over to the Confederacy with a kind of completeness and passion and sacrifice that I found impossible to understand. And that's how you come to understand that the Confederacy was this new nation that people talked themselves into believing, as they said, would be the most Christian nation on the face of the earth.
Ed Ayres. For the Confederate South, the war was a holy crusade. Evangelical revival swept through the camps of Southern armies, peaking after defeats. The Southern battle flag, based on the St. Andrew's cross, was sanctified, fusing in the imagination of Southerners with the blood of dead soldiers. They were a chosen people, doing the work of the Lord, redeeming a republic soaked in secularism and sin.
Samuel C. Clyde, 2nd South Carolina Infantry, to his wife, December 1862. Very many of our brave defenders are enlisting under the blood-stained banner of the cross of our salvation. Christian soldiers praying, the ministers of God are laboring. In short, the followers of Lord Jesus are engaged in a mighty struggle with Satan and his wicked legions, and I'm happy to add, are victorious in every conflict.
Military reversals, explain preachers, were sent by God either as a test to the people's faith or a chastisement for their sins. Ultimately, God would not surely forsake a Christian people defending their rights and their land against an invading army. The basic truth that Southern boys were literally fighting for their homeland was the Confederacy's greatest strategic strength.
The Civil War was actually quite unusual in the history of civil wars and revolutions.
James McPherson, Princeton University.
The Confederacy at the beginning of this war had political and territorial control, all of what they professed to be fighting for. And all they had to do in order to win the war was to prevent the North from invading, conquering, subduing, and destroying that infrastructure, a far easier task than the North had in order to win this war.
1st and 27th Tennessee Regiments will ever remember the Battle of Dead Angle, which was fought June 27th on the Kennesaw Line near Marietta, Georgia.
Sam Watkins was one of many thousands of Civil War soldiers who left vivid accounts of their experiences.
It was one of the hottest and longest days of the year, and one of the most desperate and determinedly resisted battles fought during the whole war. Our regiment was stationed at an angle on a little spur of the mountain. It seemed fun for the guns of the whole Yankee army to play upon this point. Even the little trees and bushes which had been left for shade were cut down as so much stubble. For more than a week, this constant firing had been kept up against this salient point. In the meantime, the skirmishing in the valley below resembled the sounds made by 10,000 wood choppers.
Both sides in this war, to be quite frank, had to learn to fight a war of this kind of scale. No American had ever experienced war on this scale or anything close to it.
Well, on the fatal morning of June 27th, the sun rose clear and cloudless. The heavens seemed made of brass and the earth of iron. And as the sun began to mount towards the zenith, everything became quiet, and no sound was heard save a peckerwood on a neighboring tree. On the distant hills, we could plainly see officers dashing about hither and thither, and the stars and stripes moving to and fro, and we knew that the Federals were making preparations for the mighty contest. It seemed that the Archangel of Death stood and looked on with outstretched wings, while all the earth was silent. All at once, 100 guns from the Federal line opened upon us. For more than an hour, they poured their solid and chain shot, grape, and shrapnel right upon this salient point, defended by our regiment alone, when all of a sudden, our pickets jumped into our works and reported the Yankees were advancing, and at almost the same time, a solid line of bluecoats came up the hill. My pen is unable to describe the scene of carnage and death that ensued in the next 2 hours. Sun beaming down on our uncovered heads, the thermometer being 110 degrees in the shade, and a solid line of blazing fire right from the muzzles of the Yankee guns being poured right into our very faces, singeing our hair and clothes, the hot blood of our dead and wounded spurting on us, the blinding smoke and stifling atmosphere filling our eyes and mouths, the awful concussion causing the blood to gush out of our noses and ears, and above all, the roar of battle made it a perfect pandemonium. All that was necessary was to load and shoot. In fact, I will ever think that the reason they did not capture our works was the impossibility of their living men passing over the bodies of their dead. The ground was piled up with one solid mass of dead and wounded Yankees. I learned afterwards from the burying squad that in some places they were piled up like cord wood, 12 deep. On the third morning, the Yankees raised a white flag. asked an armistice to bury their dead. Not for any respect either army had for the dead, but to get rid of the sickening stench. I get sick now when I happen to think about it. Afterward, I heard a soldier express himself by saying that he thought hell had broke loose in Georgia, sure enough.
The first year of the war saw victories for the Union in the West and in Virginia, where the Army of the Potomac reached the gates of Richmond. In May 1862, the South seemed on the edge of defeat. But campaigns can turn on chance. And when the Confederate commander was wounded, Jefferson Davis replaced him with a general who, more than any other figure, would become the personal embodiment of the Confederacy, Robert E. Lee.
His victories, his example of potential long-term success is what rallied the Confederate people, even in very despondent moments. They could look to him, and there came to be this sense that as long as he and his army were in the field, there was still possibility for independence. It's very like the attitude toward Washington and the Continental Army.
They had spirit on their side. They certainly had cause on their side. That is, the kind of morale, the surging desire for independence. They were a revolutionary movement, and there's a certain fervor that one can draw on with that until you face too much real war.
I love to torment the state rights people who argue it's all about state rights. I mean, the government in Richmond became the most intrusive central government in American history by far. In the spring of 1862, the war wasn't even 1 year over when they resorted to conscription. And they not only made all white males liable to service, they also changed the rules on all the men who had enlisted in good faith for 1 year. In 1861, they extended their terms to 3 years. That was considered a profound violation of, in essence, a contract between those men who had volunteered in good faith for 1 year, and now they're in the service for 2 more years. In 1864, the Confederate Congress changed the rules again and said everybody who was in uniform was in for the duration. So in essence, if the Confederate government ever got you into a uniform, you never got out. The United States government never did that. They always honored terms of enlistment. But the Confederacy also instituted an income tax. They had policy whereby they could impress, that's the word they used, horses, mules, other things they needed. They impressed slave labor from slaveholders. We need labor to construct fortifications in Richmond. Here's your quota for whatever county you are in Virginia. This much slave labor has to be given to the central government. You had to have passes to travel in the Confederacy. None of these things would have been imaginable in 1860 or 1861. All of them were considered egregious violations of what was considered the proper relationship between the central government and the state and local governments. And there was a tremendous debate within the Confederacy about this. But in the end, people accommodated themselves to it. And for the most part, they accepted it. Which is why the resistance lasted as long as it did, and they accepted it because the growing perception of just how awful defeat would be.
The awfulness of defeat for the White South would lie not just in the death of their dreams of an independent republic, but in the loss of slavery. From the start of the war, escaping slaves fled to the camps of the Union Army, eventually compelling the government in Washington to respond. On New Year's Day, 1863, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation declared that all slaves under Confederate control were now free people. The nature and the meaning of the war were now transformed. If the North prevailed, the South's world would be destroyed. Jefferson Davis called it the most execrable measure in the history of guilty man. On the day the proclamation was issued, in a small Union-occupied enclave in South Carolina, a white abolitionist from Massachusetts, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, was drilling freed slaves in what was to become the first officially sanctioned black regiment in the Union Army.
Then followed an incident so simple and so touching so utterly unexpected and startling that I can scarcely believe it on recalling it. The very moment the speaker had ceased, and just as I took and waved the flag, which now for the first time meant anything to these poor people, there suddenly arose close beside the platform a strong male voice, but a little cracked and elderly, into which two women's voices instantly blended, singing, as if by an impulse that could no more be repressed than the morning note of a song sparrow. People looked at each other and then at us on the platform to see whence came this interruption not put down in the program. Firmly and irrepressibly, the quavering voices sang on verse after verse. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Others of the colored people joined in. Some whites on the platform began, but I motioned to them to be silent. I never saw anything so electric. It made all words cheap. It seemed the choked voice of a race at last unloosed. Nothing could be more wonderfully unconscious. Art could not have dreamed of a tribute to the day of Jubilee. It should be so affecting. History will not believe it. When they stopped, there was nothing to do but try to speak. And I went on. But the life of that whole day was in those unknown people's simple song. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on.
It makes the Union Army officially an agent of emancipation. Henceforth, wherever the Union Army goes, one of its tasks, one of its responsibilities is to protect the freedom of the slaves that Lincoln has declared free.
Eric Foner.
So it changes the character of the war, not so much on January 1st, 1863, but henceforth. Now, of course, it presumes Union victory. If the South wins, the proclamation will have little effect. So it requires Union victory to be fully implemented, but it does mark a fundamental transformation in the nature of the Civil War. There's no compromise possible anymore. So the black soldiers have become both a symbol of black, you might say, incorporation into the nation, but also a part of the war effort that can't be dispensed with anymore.
Slave labor is absolutely essential to the Confederate economy and to the logistics of the Confederate Army.
James McPherson.
If you strike at this Southern resource by encouraging the slaves to come over to your own side by offering them freedom, that you're going to strike the one of the strong points of the Confederacy and turn it into a weakness. To go beyond that, slaves who were out of range of the Union armies deep in the South on the plantations knew what was going on in this war. The absence of so many white men from the plantations in the Confederate armies meant a breakdown in discipline on many Southern plantations. So slaves were not working as efficiently. And I think that they just couldn't carry on the war without that kind of a weapon being used against the South's Achilles heel.
The great nightmare was a violent slave uprising and the massacre of the white population. And I think that's how they interpreted Lincoln enrolling black troops in the Union Army. And of course, at the beginning, Jefferson Davis said, we do not recognize them as soldiers. They are, to use a modern phrase, unlawful combatants. They are rebellious slaves. First, he said, they're going to be executed. We will not treat them as prisoners of war. They are rebellious slaves. They will be treated according to the law of the South. But that became impossible, you know, and very soon they had to treat them as prisoners of war because Lincoln said, if you don't treat them as prisoners of war, we will not treat your prisoners of war as prisoners of war. But it is certainly true that many instances exist of black soldiers being massacred after Fort Pillow, but others after surrendering. There were white officers in the South who refused to take black prisoners. And certainly the prospect of armed black soldiers was the most horrible of all the things Lincoln did. From their point of view, you know, under slavery, it was illegal for any black person, free or slave, to own a firearm.
In the spring of 1864, George Hatton, a former slave, now a non-commissioned sergeant in the 1st Regiment of U.S. Colored Troops, was in Jamestown, Virginia, when he witnessed a group of liberated slaves confronting their former master.
While out on a foraging expedition, we captured Mr. Clayton, a noted Reb in this part of the country, and on the day before, we captured several colored women that belonged to Mr. C., who had given them a most unmerciful whipping previous to their departure. The commanding officer determined to let the women have their revenge. Oh, that I had the tongue to express my feelings while standing upon the banks of the James River on the soil of Virginia, the mother state of slavery, as a witness to such a sudden reverse. The day is clear. The fields of grain are beautiful, and the birds are singing sweet, melodious songs, while poor Mr. C. is crying to his servants for mercy. Let all who sympathize for the South take this narrative for a mirror.
In November 1864, Union General William T. Sherman launched his march through Georgia from Atlanta to the sea with the aim of breaking Southern resistance. "We cannot change the hearts of those people of the South," Sherman wrote, "but we can make war so terrible that generations would pass away before they would again appeal to it." More than any other event in the war, Sherman's march has come to symbolize the humiliation of the Southern people at the hands of an unforgiving enemy. Yet white Southern resistance still did not break. Gary Gallagher.
Sherman swept through Georgia. The civilians threw their hands up, said, "It's hopeless. We give up. We don't care. We don't care if there's a Confederacy. Let's just stop the destruction and the killing." Now, often what would be cited to support that was William Tecumseh Sherman, who said that. And, of course, he had a reason to say his campaign had been that successful. He's the most quotable general on either side. He had no filter between his brain and either his mouth or his pen. So you get wonderfully quotable things from him. But, in fact, there have been two very good studies of reaction among Georgians. Very quickly, there's an even more resolute determination not to give in to any opponent who, from their point of view, behaved in a barbaric fashion.
Janie Smith, April 12, 1865. The Yankees came charging, yelling and howling, right into the house, breaking open bureau drawers of all kinds faster than I could unlock. They cursed us for having hid everything and made bold threats if certain things were not brought to light, but all to no effect. They took Pa's hat and stuck him pretty badly with a bayonet to make him disclose something, but you know they were fooling with the wrong man. Every nook and corner of the premises was searched, and the things that they didn't use were burned or torn into strings. I had heard that the officers would protect ladies, but it is not so. They got all of my stockings and some of our collars and handkerchiefs. If I ever see a Yankee woman, I intend to whip her and take the clothes off of her very back.
It hardens people's will. It makes them hate their opponent even more. It makes them less willing to consider reaching some kind of an accommodation with that enemy.
In the end, it was not the destruction of homes that caused the Confederacy to collapse, but the defeat of their armies. And the Confederate armies, by the spring of 1865, were running out of supplies, of men, of options.
The once proud Army of Tennessee had degenerated to a mob. We were pinched by hunger and cold. Rains and sleet and snow never ceased falling from the winter sky, while winds pierced the old ragged gray-backed rebel soldier to his very marrow. The clothing of many were hanging around them in shreds of rags and tatters, while an old slouched hat covered their frozen ears. Some were on old raw-boned horses without saddles. Our country is gone. Our cause is lost. Actum est de Republica.
I'm at Appomattox, southwestern Virginia. It was here on April 9th, 1865, that General Lee's ragged, dispirited Army of Northern Virginia surrendered to General Grant. And they came here to this house. General Lee dismounted and walked up these wooden steps into the parlor of this house where General Grant was waiting.
Anna Francis, Georgia, The bare idea of a full-blown Yankee hero or heroine is preposterous. They made no sacrifices. They suffered no loss. And there's nothing on their side to call up scenes of pathos or heroism.
Lee did something very important here at Appomattox. It wasn't just the fact of his surrender to General Grant. That obviously mattered. It was the message he sent to his troops, the Army of Northern Virginia. After 4 years of arduous service, he told them, marked by unsurpassed courage and fortitude, the Army of Northern Virginia has been compelled to yield to overwhelming numbers and resources. Compelled to yield. Right at the moment of his defeat, he's retrospectively imposing a meaning on the Civil War that it certainly didn't have for Confederates at the beginning of the war. If they were compelled to yield to overwhelming numbers and resources, then they never had a chance to win. But all the heroism is on their side. Of course the North won. The North had more men, more resources. It had more industrial might. It had a more efficient railroad network. The South had the valor and the nobility that came from those who were willing to die for a noble but ultimately a lost cause.
Kate Stone, April 1865. All are fearfully depressed. I cannot bear to hear them talk of defeat. It seems a reproach to our gallant dead. I hope the thousands of grass-grown mounds heaped on mountainside and in every valley of our country would still rally the South to be free or die.
We're here in the University Cemetery at the University of Virginia, and part of the cemetery is devoted to Confederate dead. This monument sitting in the middle of this part of the cemetery was the first Confederate monument put up in Charlottesville, put up in the 1890s. I've always loved the text on this monument, which proclaims that fate denied them victory but crowned them with glorious immortality. It's just perfect lost cause. You can't win if fate isn't on your side, so it's a hopeless cause. But you're gloriously immortal because you waged such a gallant struggle against hopeless odds with those millions of Yankees and Robert E. Lee with his handful of men. It's just absolutely perfect. And it's a wonderful expression of how the notion of a Confederate nation carries on. It captures much of what was at the center of how former Confederates chose to remember the war.
At the very end of the war, we must make no mistake, the Confederates were defeated, utterly defeated. No Americans have ever experienced defeat on this kind of total level. Social destruction, political destruction, military destruction.
David Blight.
This was a society in ruin. And white Southerners may have been, by and large, bitter as they felt, defeated as they were, ready and prepared to accept almost any terms, almost any regime that the North might impose upon them.
Reconstruction wrought for a while a dramatic revolution in the Southern racial order. Congress enshrined the rights of African Americans as equal citizens, and within 3 years of being freed, black men were given the right to vote. But white Southerners fought back, at the ballot box and using force. As the great black intellectual W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "The slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, then moved back again towards slavery."
It's a tragedy that Reconstruction failed, and of course it took 100 years until the Civil Rights era, or what is sometimes called the Second Reconstruction, for the principles that were put into the law and Constitution in the 1860s to be fully implemented in the 1960s. But they were there. That's the legacy of Reconstruction, creating what Charles Sumner called these sleeping giants, this principle of equality, which had never existed before the Civil War, which was now put into our laws and Constitution to be reinvigorated by later generations.
150 years after the White South launched its bid to create a separate slaveholding nation, to reconcile American liberty with human bondage, the United States has a president whose daughters are the direct descendants of American slaves. The cause for which one in five Southern white men died is now more lost than ever. Next week, how and why the North fought and won. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
planned. In fact, that next programme is tomorrow night at the later start time of 9:45 here on BBC Radio 3. American Civil War, The War of the South, was presented by Adam Smith. The readers were Sid Griffin, William Hope, Lorelei King and Danny Sapani. The programme was produced by Mark Berman and first broadcast in April last year. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10 o'clock and coming up at 11:30 tonight, Fiona Torkington introduces tonight's Late Junction. Right now, though, from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall in London, here's Andrew McGregor with the second of this evening's proms.
It seems strange to be introducing the proms debut of the Kronos Quartet. How can that be possible? They've been around almost 40 years, 40 years next year, in fact. I suppose they must have been busy every summer working on some of the 750-plus new works they've premiered over their extraordinary lifespan so far. And we'll be hearing one of the newest tonight. When I asked Kronos' leader, David Harrington, what was behind the design of this evening's programme, he told me he wanted to bring us something vast, something big enough for this huge space, and as an upbeat to the opening of the London Olympics. It's also a multicultural celebration. We begin with the intoxicating sound of Syrian pop music from a country currently torn by civil war. Kronos ends the concert with music by Alexandra Vrebelov from former Yugoslavia, reminding us that the differences that led to civil war in the Balkans can also lead to the most rewarding fusions in music. Between those bookends, Kronos brings us more proms premieres. Sofia Gubaidulina's fourth quartet with the delicious sound of strings played with little rubber balls. There's Amazing Grace, reimagined by American composer Ben Johnston. There's tonight's world premiere, Nicole Lisée's radiophonic workshop piece, Fiber Optic Flowers, and that concerns some of the paraphernalia you can already see on stage behind me. Tapes, arcade games, oscillators, cassettes, and a turntable. And there's a tale of unrequited love from Sweden. Now, the first number is also a love song, a piece of party music by Syrian star Omar Suleiman, and it's called I'll Prevent the Hunters from Hunting You. It's a song for a new lover. And David Harrington was reminding me earlier that most of the videos for Suleiman's hits involve the singer mustachioed in his trademark keffiyeh and shades, dancing or eloping with a woman, which may or may not happen after this evening's performance. David's going to be introducing the pieces for us on stage, so making their long overdue BBC Proms debut, please welcome the Kronos Quartet, violinists David Harrington and John Sherver, viola player Hank Dutt, cellist Jeffrey Ziegler. Thank you.
A song by Syrian pop star Omar Suleiman, arranged for the Kronos Quartet by Jacob Garchik. And the Kronos, they're listening to the backing track through earpieces. And viola player Hank Dutt actually playing the goblet drum tucked under his left arm. And next we're going to hear a work by Sofia Gubaidulina. I'll let David Harrington introduce this himself.
Thank you very much. That was music of Omar Suleiman, a piece called I'll Prevent the Hunters from Hunting You. And next we're going to play for you music by Sofia Gubaidulina, a piece written in 1994 for Kronos. It's her string quartet number 4. Thank you.
The real rising from the unreal. Sophia Gubaidulin has owned a brief description of her string quartet number 4, written for the ensemble you've just heard, giving its first Proms performance. The Kronos Quartet, who by the end had finally acquired the ability to make the same otherworldly sounds as the two recorded quartets, using the little rubber balls on wires scraped along the strings.
Thank you very much. Our next piece was written by the American composer Ben Johnston. It's a set of variations on the Scottish tune Amazing Grace that's now become an American tune. It's a string quartet number 4, Amazing Grace by Ben Johnston. Thank you.